You're listening to Season to Taste, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the TV Movie. Hello!
Hello.
That isn't actually the subtitle of this episode of Season to Taste. It's a cunning reference to a DVD extra, one for the fans there. Matthew, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Will, how are you?
I'm very good as well. That is a useful coincidence because it means we don't need to go into any more detail about what might be wrong with our lives. So, in the last episode, we are... He's making a lovely face there. I meant like I've got a cold or something. Anyway, that's not what we're here for. What we're here for...
It's not for here.
Let's not listen. We are here, I'm going to edit so much of that out, we are here to mark the 50th birthday in this year of Doctor Who by tasting one story from each season of Doctor Who. And in each episode we ask the randomizer to pick us a season at random, we're not doing them in chronological order. And having chosen, we will watch them and then tell you what we thought. And following the randomizer's decision and our decision in the last episode, we are back once again with the Renegade Master... talking about the TV movie from 1996.
I don't get it.
It's a pop reference, don't worry about it. So, simple question, Matthew. Did you enjoy the TV movie from 1996?
For the most part, yeah, I did.
Excellent, so moving on.
Yeah.
No, carry on.
No, I think the most enduring thing that's come out of it is the variation of the Pertwee logo, which now seems to be plastered on everything ever. However,
Paul McGann will be pleased to learn that's the most enduring thing that's come out of it.
It's appeared in much more than Paul McGann has. No, I think, you know, there's a couple of really hideous bits, like the Seventh Doctor's spitty chin in the TARDIS.
There is a lot of spittle. There's a bit of McGann spittle in there, there's a bit of McCoy spittle, there's obviously some Master
spittle. It's the spit of Rassilon, isn't it?
It's all over the place.
Well, the seal of Rassilon's everywhere, so it's not surprising that the spit of Rassilon should appear as much as well.
And the Seal of Rassilon is, of course, a small mammal.
But, yes, it's really obvious what the problems are. The biggest problem with it is that it shouldn't open on the interior of the TARDIS. It's a lovely new interior. It looks really good, and it's obviously inspired.
It looks like a country house.
It does, but it's obviously inspired the new series. The new series can't even match the scale and opulence of that set, but the kind of crunchy teeth, time rotor... The kind of time rotor
particularly the new Matt Smith console has the crunchy teeth.
The kind of pull down on a string monitor that the Doctor spins around. The console's very tactile, and I really like that about it. And I think it's an obvious inspiration for the design in the new series. But the most obvious issue is it shouldn't have started inside the TARDIS. I think you quite rightly made the point that this should have been Grace's story up until the moment when the Doctor dies on the operating table. We should have started with Grace having problems with her relationship with Brian.
Yes,
we should have stuck with her.
You can. All you have to do is compare it with Rose to see the right and wrong way to do it. Although one thing I do disagree about, and I disagree with you and with kind of received wisdom, I don't actually think that is the biggest problem with it. We'll come on to what I think is the biggest problem with it. But I also think while it's probably true to say that at the time... you could possibly have done without Sylvester being in it and done the Rose thing of just Paul McGann turning up. There is actually something interesting about setting up, again, if it's done from Grace's point of view, a man arriving on her operating table, dying,
The first time you should have met the Doctor was when he's dying on Grace's operating table. Nice little cameo from Sylvester McCoy, then straight into Paul McGann.
And actually, while I can understand why at the time people thought maybe it would have been better if Sylvester hadn't been in it at all, from the point of view of the storytelling and introducing it to a new audience in America, because it didn't turn into a series, and because it is now the bridgehead between the old and new series, having Sylvester in it in that way is the glue that ties it backwards.
Yeah.
And it means that now, because there wasn't a series that followed it, actually it's quite nice to have that there. But I completely agree that we shouldn't be following it at the beginning with a voiceover about the Master, some Pinky and Perky Daleks, and then some weird stuff in the TARDIS. It should be starting with and have Lee encountering him, but actually starting with Grace.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a lovely bit which again feels like it potentially influenced Rose, where Chang Li goes into the TARDIS and comes out, walks all the way around and goes back in. just as Rose does in Rose. And that should have been our first introduction to the TARDIS, because it's once he then goes back inside the second time and you see this huge country house type TARDIS,
that should be the reveal.
It's a great reveal. Mm. But it's been ruined by...
because you've sat there watching it for 5 minutes at the beginning of the film.
Mysteriously being in at the start of the film. So I don't think there's a problem with McCoy being in it. I actually think he's pretty good in it. I think it's more the way that he's used to... and I suppose he's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the massive info dump that we're provided with in the first few minutes, when actually we ought to have been getting to know the characters and getting invested in this world. That's the real big problem. The first 5-10 minutes... it's just a string of info dump about Scaro and the Master being on trial. Very tell, not show.
Yeah, and actually, but my biggest problem with it, although I do think those are problems, my biggest problem with it is the plot as a whole that just doesn't really make sense, doesn't hang together. There's the dialogue has loads of good stuff going for it, the cast have loads of good things going for it, the production values are there, but the actual story that it's telling... from, including, you know, that mishmash at the beginning, but the stuff about beryllium atomic clocks and turning back time, and it's just really hard to follow what's supposed to be going on, and it doesn't hang together. And if you're, you know, you either have to switch off your brain and go, I don't really know what this is about. You've got Grace wiring the TARDIS, despite the fact that she has no, you know, she isn't a Time Lord, she isn't even... a physicist, not that I think a physicist from Earth would be able to rewire the TARDIS either, but she's there. You know, there's all these weird jumps in the plot that just don't make any sense. Little things like, one of the tiny things I thought was amusing was that the doctor gets chained up wearing this kind of metal
corset thing,
which presumably he already had lying around the TARDIS and the Master went and got, because there's this time the Master's gone and built it from somewhere. It's conveniently there. Oh yeah, I'll just get... pop to the doctor's little bondage room and get out the chains and the
metal. Sylvester McCoy's doctor was secretly a sadomasochist.
Ace!
That casts a sinister new light on the Wilderness Years.
It probably happened in A New Adventure, and I just don't remember. I mean, they were too bored, too deep, and too kinky for the small screen. and the thing that I think actually is outstanding about the TV movie, Jeffrey Sachs's direction, is possibly the best direction in the whole of Doctor Who. And it's not just about it being nicely made. I think there's a level of detail, and I don't know how much of this is in the script, there's a level of detail and thought to thematic repetition that goes beyond just, you know, some nice visuals. And there are some really nice visuals and some really nice shots that he can do because he has the budget and the locations that Doctor Who never had before. Yeah. But also, things like, particularly the eye, which is the most obvious thing, there are eyes everywhere.
And clocks all the time.
There's clocks
loads
as well.
On clocks. Loads of point of view shots.
But particularly the eyes, where there's some which may... I don't know how... Again, as I say, I don't know how many are in the script, but obviously there are things like the Eye of Harmony that are in the script, because that is actually what it's about. But then it's Lee's eye opening the Eye of Harmony. It's the Master taking his glasses off and having horrible eyes behind, or Grace's eyes turning black. There's the Master's eyes when he's exterminated at the beginning, rolling off like the old special effects in Nightmare, where the life force was dying, the eyeballs would roll off. When Sylvester is regenerating, there's close-ups on the eyes. I think there's close-ups on the eyes on the operating table, and he's looking up and he's seeing Grace's eyes really close. It's the first time you see Grace at the opera. It's the close-up of her tear. There's just everywhere. There's eye, and obviously, I mean, extreme close-ups of eyes, not just like there are eyes in. There are obviously eyes on TV when actors are on screen.
I get your point.
But oh, and even to the point when the funny old lady in her kitchen is chopping up the fish early on, the shot starts with a shot of the fish's eye.
You battered me into submission with your point about the eyes.
I know,
there
that's like
of eyes.
16 eyes in one sentence.
Yeah, it makes you sound a very egotistical young lady. So I think you're right, the direction is really impressive. It's pretty showy. I'm not entirely sure I agree with you about Jeffrey Sachs is the best director, because I think he probably had a lot more resources than Graham Harper.
I think it is the best directed piece of Doctor Who. I don't mean he's the best director.
Very differently directed. It's really interesting to watch, and I think it does look really well made. There's bits of it that just look really good, which is really let down a little bit by the quality of the DVD, which the effects shots just looks awful.
It really does. I don't know. I mean, I assume they just weren't rendered even originally at a high enough quality. But you're watching it now, particularly those effect shots, just look terrible. They're so grainy.
I do. They look like they've been ripped off of VHS. But no, I like your point as well that it's a bridge between the old series and the new series, because it kind of feels like some of the problems are they want to tell a kind of character-driven story, but it's still very much got that hangover of the very plot-driven stories of the old series. So it's a really uneasy mix of Grace's emotional problems and her childhood problems and the Doctor being the answer to those. The kind of thematic and emotional depth that some of the Russell T Davies stories had. Because Russell T Davies wrote a lot of techno-babbly stories. I mean, the whole adipose thing, where the Doctor goes in the cupboard with Donna and presses some buttons and that sorts out the plot. No one would necessarily argue that the TV movie is any less silly in some of its technical side. But I think it doesn't make up for it well enough with the emotional side of things, with the characters, to actually balance out the fact that the plot's a bit all over the place. You know, I love Grace as a character. I think Daphne Ashbrook does a great job with her. And I love the kind of screwball comedy relationship that she has with Paul McGann. I think that works really well. I could see that partnership working in a series. I think Grace is set up well as a character. She's set up very capable.
Yeah. There's that lovely scene where she's arguing with the hospital boss who's burning the x-rays and threatening to resign. And it's very much that she wants to get to the bottom of things, but it never feels like she's been forcibly made.
No, she just feels like she's kind of a 90s female character.
Yeah, she's Scully, or...
Well, she's more wacky than Scully. She's overtly comic.
You'd want to go to the pub with her more than Scully.
Yeah, but she's a funny character, and I like that. And actually, you know, for all the Eighth Doctor novels made out that the Eighth Doctor was this very earnest, innocent, kind of no, Sam, oh, I'm very nice and lovely. Mm. Actually, Paul McGann's performance has slight elements of that, but he's actually very sardonic and sarcastic.
He has those moments of joy, you know, the whole these shoes, they fit perfectly moment. But even that, what's fun and doctorish about that moment is more about his mind darting between two different conversations
than being some kind of...
Being a lover of life, yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, there are some wonderful scenes where he's just really sarcastic to Grace.
Yeah, and he's quite abrupt with her when he's trying to convince her that the world's going to be destroyed. Midnight tonight, Grace, I will prove to you that the planet is falling inside out. And he says something like, oh yes, very witty, Grace, or something like that. He's quite short with her at points. And I think Paul McGann's...
is quite short.
He is quite short. But his take on the Doctors is he's very sardonic. You know, he casts a kind of almost Liverpudlian eye over things and makes sarcastic comment on them. I think the Eighth Doctor works pretty well. I could quite happily have watched more of Paul McGann in that role.
Yeah. Your mention there of Midnight is just another of those silly plot points where you're thinking, well, what is it about Midnight that means that's the time where this is going to kick in? How convenient for the fact that it's set on New Year's Eve.
And the thing is, if it had been a Russell T Davies episode, he would still have used Midnight, but the Doctor would have said something like, oh, it would be Midnight, or something like that. It would have
but
been
also,
over...
The Doctor works this all out standing in a park, almost telepathically. He doesn't actually discover it. He gets a hint of the Master in the open eye, and all of a sudden just decides...
Yeah, it's very clumsy. It's the exposition, yeah.
I just remembered another couple of things. I don't really want to retread the direction issue, but I mean, as well as the clocks, we talked about the eyes, there's lots of stuff about identity, mirrors, people looking at their own reflection, and also a lot of really interesting parallel scenes, actually saying the Doctor and the Master are two sides of the same coin. They're going through the same things. They're both experiencing new bodies. And as the Doctor's getting used to his new body, the Master is getting used to Bruce's body, and they're cutting between those scenes and showing them actually going through the same thing. There's a lot of really nice touches of storytelling like that.
Yeah.
I think maybe then we should talk about the Master. Obviously, a different portrayal from maybe what we're used to, the first American Master.
Mm-hmm.
I think he actually works quite well. Eric Roberts, for a start, is really different as Bruce and the Master.
Mm-hmm.
He may ham it up no end as the Master, but actually that's quite fun and fairly in keeping with Ainley and Delgado. Delgado hams it up when he wants to, something chronic, in a very enjoyable way. And it's one of the reasons why he's a good character and a worthwhile character to bring back. I love the really stupid dress for the occasion thing. It's bizarre. That rather glam outfit.
Mm-hmm.
and the way he hangs around Chang Li, who is practically his companion, which is another parallel in the stories. There's something obviously quite homoerotic in the way that that's done, and he kisses Chang Li, and the way he forces his head down when he opens the eye is itself slightly dodgy. Speaking of which, there's obviously, while we're talking about really dirty moments, that glorious moment where Bruce's wife, played by Eric Roberts' wife, he says, "Call me master," and she just says, "Call me master," and she just says,
"Oh, master,
come back to bed, master." Oh, you've got the wrong end of the stick here, love. He's not interested in you.
It's interesting, isn't it, that it's the first time the master's got a wife, and the next time we see him, he'll get one and keep her.
He got the idea.
I think the movie for me is interesting because it's a kind of historic link between the old series and the new series. I think the end, when Grace and Chang Li are resurrected by the mysterious golden light, well, that's pretty much what happens to Captain Jack. I do wonder whether Grace and Chang Li are going to live forever, never die, just like Captain Jack. I like to think that wandering around now in San Francisco are an ageless Grace and Chang Li, and every time that they die, they come back to life.
Running Torchwood 12.
Yeah. But, you know, that's, although it was heavily criticised at the time as being sentimental, even the Doctor points that out in the film, it's not really different than what happens now.
I mean, I think they kind of get away with it because the Doctor's been having all these speeches about Grace having a dream to hold back death. I don't really like the way the Doctor just looks at her and tells her what her childhood dream is. I don't mind a Doctor that's a little bit telepathic, or a Doctor that knows, you know, he knows Gareth's future, the guard at the Institute, because he becomes famous. I don't really like the idea that he knows what he needs to say on a test. The idea that the Doctor can just look at people and see their time strands. There wouldn't be much need for him to do things. And so I don't really like that he can just look at Grace and go, "Here's your childhood dream," when he's not ever, we assume, met her before.
No.
But having seeded that, it kind of permits the end. The trouble is, there's so much running around, wittering about alarm clocks. You know, I'm quite sci-fi literate and quite science literate, and I don't have a clue what he's talking about with the whole sentinel alarm clock thing.
It doesn't make any sense, and it's almost time monsterish in its nonsensicalness.
Yes.
Other bits that I love, I like the bits inside the kind of big Christmas party with the beryllium atomic clock, and Grace, Professor Ragg and the Doctor, and Grace being offered champagne and her eyes lighting up, and then
yes,
disappointed when the Doctor pulls her away.
Although the Doctor pulls her and Professor Ragg over in order to share his secret that he's half human on his mother's side.
Yeah.
I think
he'd been drinking champagne, personally. I think it's all rubbish.
There's a section of fandom, and I quite appreciate this kind of retconned that, with Lung Barrow and everything else, and God, look, he's actually the other he's talking about, and the other's mother is Leela, and so that all makes sense. But I mean, this whole bizarre thing of the Master going, "The Doctor is half human," oh, that explains so much. Why did they do that? It's completely...
Well, my retcon in it is that the Doctor makes a point that he can change species when he dies. I think because the regeneration went a bit botched, and Grace was all over the Doctor poking him about inside, that the Eighth Doctor is half human because he's got bits of Grace's DNA inside him.
I think on his mother's side is a bit of a joke. Then.
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't add anything to the story at all. It actually smacks, I assume it smacks to the producer saying, "Oh, I'm going to bring something new to Doctor Who here that I like," and asking it to be written in. I might be wrong, it may be a Matthew Jacobs original, but it doesn't feel like it.
They're trying to set up an American TV series where that's obviously going to be one of the character mysteries, and presumably that they would have answered it at some point. You read things like The Nth Doctor or the Gary Russell Regeneration book about the making of the TV movie and some of the kind of series Bibles that were written around that time, and you can see all this stuff about Ulysses being the Doctor's father and Cardinal Barusa being, you know, a mentor and stuff about Gallifrey. And it feels like a bit of a hangover from those early drafts. I personally don't think it works. I think it's an unnecessary addition to the character. It's obviously something that's never been followed up in the new series, where the Doctor clearly isn't half human, right. I think. However you want to retcon it, it's not been a massive affliction on the future of the series. So I think it's just
a jarring moment in the story.
You can ignore it.
Yeah, talking about it as an American series, it's interesting, particularly early on, with the Chinese gangsters running around, that actually there's a real feel of an American action series happening there. And it says something about the versatility of Doctor Who as a series, that the TARDIS could materialise in an American action show and not seem any more out of place than anywhere else, and the Doctor with his strange English oddness can just wander in. But Doctor Who is such a versatile format that it just adapts and does its story and then moves on.
Yeah.
It's quite a violent story by Doctor Who standards. From, you know, the Doctor's got bloody probes stuck in him, there's machine guns being shot at people and who are actually being shot, although the Seventh Doctor is very lucky in that despite having a whole load of people with machine guns firing him, he apparently only gets 3 bullets in him, none of which is actually fatal. It's Grace that accidentally kills him, it's not the bullets. But you even got these moments of body horror with the Master peeling away his fingernails.
Yeah. You know, the TV movie gets a lot wrong. I wouldn't have wanted Doctor Who to go out on that note, and I think the fact that we've had, you know, 6 or 7 years of the new series has made the TV movie feel faults less egregious in retrospect, because it's no longer the last Doctor Who story. It's just like getting hung up about things that you don't like about Vengeance on Varos.
I always say
years later,
one of the problems any Doctor Who story has when it's first broadcast is that you want it to be the best Doctor Who story you've ever seen. And when it isn't, you're a bit disappointed. But in a week's time, there's another one.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really matter that the last one wasn't the best ever. You start to assess it for what it is. And, of course, the problem with the TV movie is that after it was broadcast, there wasn't any more Doctor Who for another 9 years.
Yeah.
And then the series kicked on again, and actually now we can look back at it as just one of many, a bit of a curio in its format, but actually it stands up alongside other stories perfectly well.
It does. It's a shame that it was a failure commercially. On balance, it's probably a failure creatively as well. But as we've said, as we've gone through this discussion, there are lots of little details that are picked up by the new series, which suggests that although they didn't get it entirely right, the production team were kind of thinking along the right lines.
You know, yeah.
They have the Doctor having a much more obviously romantic and human relationship with his companion. That's something that's clearly picked up by the new series, and it doesn't exist anywhere else in the old series. It only exists in that one episode. So it's interesting that, you know, they start to get towards the new series conception of the Doctor with Paul McGann, and he feels, despite the costume and everything, he feels like a step towards David Tennant and Matt Smith rather than a nod back to Tom Baker or John Pertwee.
I think that's quite right. And at the time, it was obviously quite disappointing that there wasn't another episode afterwards, and that was it. In retrospect, I think, while it's a shame there weren't more Paul McGann TV stories, I don't have a lot of confidence based on that TV movie that the series would have been as good as the series we later got. And in a way, if they had carried on then, we may never have got the 2005 series. Yeah. And I'm prepared to accept the sacrifice of those 9 years for what we then had. They probably would have done an all right TV series, but it may not have been brilliant.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think what we've got from 2005 onwards, I'm pretty confident, is better than what we would have got in 1997 had Universal and Fox or whoever made it agreed that they were going to go to a full 12 or 26 episodes. Particularly when, as I say, you read things like The Nth Doctor and the Regeneration book and you see some of the ideas that they had. But that said, although we didn't get more Paul McGann on TV, we have been lucky enough to get quite a number of years of Paul McGann on audio. And we said last time we were going to listen to one of the Paul McGann Big Finish audios because it's a bit of a taste for you.
Yes, I mean, what we actually said was if there was time, and as it turned out, we haven't really had time to listen properly. So we had a little bit.
We kind of listened to the first episode of Max Warp.
We chose Max Warp because it's
the one that Big Finish are using to promote their Eighth Doctor Adventures range at the moment.
And I did fall asleep, which is no comment on Max Warp. It's entirely the fact that I was listening to it as I went to sleep and nodded off before the end of the episode. But even from that, I can certainly see exactly what you mean about the Doctor and Lucy as a pairing. I think there's a really good dynamic there between two of them. Sheridan Smith's clearly a really good, relaxed companion. And if you had, we were saying, watching the TV movie, that if there were a multi-doctor story this year, I hadn't even stopped to think about if there would be companions.
Yeah.
And actually, it would be nice if the Eighth Doctor was on TV to have Grace in it, because actually she's as important in the TV movie as he is.
Yeah.
But actually, it would be really good to have Lucy Miller, because Sheridan Smith, as well as being a name and a successful actress anyway, has a really good relationship with the Eighth Doctor.
Yeah. And I mean, I've listened to all of the Eighth Doctor audios over the years. I always look forward to those the most, because I do like Paul McGann's performance. I don't think it's the best performance as the Doctor, and I don't necessarily agree that it's the best thing about the TV movie, but I think he's very good. He's a good actor, and it's good to have him as one of the Doctors. I think when you listen to things like Max Warp and you hear him having that kind of sparky screwball relationship with Lucy, where he's obviously enjoying himself, they've got a nice rapport and they've got a good back and forth banter.
It really does feel like the same character as in the TV movie.
It does. And what I like most about the TV movie is the way that the Eighth Doctor and Grace interact. What I like most about the Lucy Miller audios is the way that Paul McGann and Sheridan Smith interact. And I think when you've got a Doctor like Paul McGann, who wants to play it kind of sardonic, he wants to play it with a bit of a sarcastic edge to it, it's good when you've got someone as feisty as Lucy Miller to bounce off, because they do lift all of the audios that they're in. I think it's really great that Paul McGann's had the opportunity to flesh out the role a little bit more on audio, and I do hope he gets a chance to do it again on TV.
Cool. Well, that is the TV movie and a little bit of the audios, and that is the Eighth Doctor done. That's our first completed Doctor, not very hard, really, in the circumstances. So, let us consult the randomizer and find out which Doctor we'll be watching next. We know it won't be the Eighth Doctor, but it could be any of the others. So, randomizer, please tell us which season to taste. Ready?
Always.
Right. I know, I said that every time. I'm just moving the conversation on. I have on the randomizer screen the number of the next season we will be tasting.
Okay.
And it is a Doctor we've not watched yet.
So, just to remember, we've watched John Pertwee, we've watched
Colin Baker,
Sylvester McCoy, Paul McGann, obviously, and we've also done a Matt Smith. So we've done 50, just about 50% of them. So who is it this time?
It is Patrick Troughton, and it is season 6.
Ah, the existing season. That's helpful.
So, that's actually also quite a lot to think about, which one we watch.
Yeah, so we've got the Dominators,
yeah.
We've got the Mind Robber, we've got the Invasion, we've got the Crotons, the Seeds of Death, we've got the Space Pirates, and the War Games.
So that's quite a choice. 7 different stories there,
yeah.
Including my favourite Patrick Troughton story. I think maybe let's look at them one by one in turn, and then come back. So why might we watch The Dominators?
We're not watching The Dominators.
Well, that's resolved, that one. I think the answer is because it's got Brian Cant in. That isn't, however, enough reason.
No.
I actually haven't seen The Dominators for a long, long time, but I understand that maybe it's not the best example for us to go to. So the next one is The Mind Robber. Obviously, The Mind Robber, quite a standout, interesting, different concept. Very different from almost everything except maybe the Celestial Toymaker that had gone before.
Yeah.
Interesting for its missing
and
for
its Zoe's bum.
And Zoe's bum. And also it's got a Bernard Horsfall
in,
who died recently, so another reason to watch that.
And you've just reminded me, one reason I love season 6, I think it's the best Patrick Troughton season, is because I love Wendy Padbury. I think Zoe is by far a better companion than Victoria, and I really enjoy watching her. So.
After that we have The Invasion.
Classic. The iconic Cyberman story, I think. Them coming down the stairs outside St Paul's Cathedral it's like the Daleks on Westminster Bridge.
Yeah.
It's one of the iconic Doctor Who images. First unit story, first story where
the Brigadier is the Brigadier.
First Brigadier story that exists.
Yeah. Introduction of
Tobias Vaughan's great villain.
And obviously that's also got the animated missing episodes, which we can watch.
Yep. The really good animated episodes from Cosgrove Hall.
So then we have the Crotons. Such power would set me up above the gons.
Yep, and I like the Crotons. It was the only four-part story that existed for Patrick Troughton for quite a long time, so it was always the one they chose to do repeats of. Actually, I think it's got an unfair reputation. It's Robert Holmes' first script, so it's quite a historic and noteworthy story.
Uh-huh. The Seeds of Death?
Again, Ice Warriors, really amazingly directed. I think it's by the same guy that directed The Ambassadors of Death, and it's a pretty... It's got some pretty amazing direction.
I actually remember, I think I've only watched it a couple of times, and I haven't watched it recently, when I first hired the video from the library years and years ago to watch it, I actually remember being quite disappointed by it. I just remember lots of foam, but I'm sure it's better than I
remember. To be honest, that's true of 90% of Patrick Troughton stories, because they obviously bought the foam machine before.
The Space Pirate, there's a story with another reputation.
Yeah, only one episode if that exists. I think it's a really hard story to judge because obviously it was broadcast around the time of the moon landings when proper gritty space travel was all the rage, and you know that the whole thing revolves around very slow space travel, very realistic space travel. So it's kind of hard, you know, 40 odd years after the fact to think how it must have been in 1969 when actually people probably thought, wow, this is so realistic.
Although space travel is still quite slow.
It is, but it's quite boring now because we've done it.
And Doctor Who and the War Games by Terence Dix and Malcolm Hulk.
Yeah, which is obviously fantastic.
But also 10 episodes. I think we'll discount the Space Pirates on the grounds that there is only one episode and there isn't an animated version of it. And we've got a load of other ones that do exist.
Well, we're going to avoid doing audio only until we have to, I guess.
Yeah, well, if you know, if it was a season where it was half and half, then maybe. But when it's just the Space Pirates, let's skip that. And let's discount the Dominators because you just really don't want to watch it. I would love to watch the War Games because it is my favourite Patrick Troughton story and one of my favourite stories, full stop. Perhaps 10 episodes is a little too long for us to be popping into taste if we actually want to get another episode recorded. We haven't got a lot of time to sit through 10 episodes, I think.
If we're trying to be a bit representative of the season and the era, the War Games is possibly the least representative Patrick Troughton story.
Between that and the Mind Robber, neither of them is very representative.
But I think the Mind Robber slightly more because of the kind of psychedelic overtones. The War Games is really weird. I mean, it's the first Troughton historical since... Well, the Highlanders, really. Different kind of Patrick Troughton story.
Okay, so that leaves us with... I don't want to watch The Mind Robber because, again, I don't think it's especially representative, but also it's the one that I saw in the 90s when they started repeating.
Yeah, of course, it was broadcast in 92, wasn't it?
And I know that. I know it quite well. And to be honest, for all its interesting ideas, there isn't much to it.
Really? I slightly disagree. I think it's a really outstanding Patrick Troughton story, but I'm... As you are, I'm very, very familiar with it. It was the first Patrick Troughton story I owned on video back in the early 90s, and I definitely watched it way more than the other Patrick Troughton story.
Well, that leaves us with The Invasion, The Crotons, and The Seeds of Death. Of those three, I'm fairly relaxed about any of them. I love to watch The Invasion. It's a really good story. I love Kevin Stoney in particular in it. Yeah. It's got Swinging London, and as you say, it's really iconic. And more representative, you know, the Cybermen crop up so many times in the Troughton era that actually that is a bit more representative. It'd be interesting to see the Croton. I've seen it once on video years ago. Most of what I remember about it, I remember from the novelisation rather than from the TV story. And The Seeds of Death, I suspect I underrate a fair bit, and so it might be worth...
Yeah, The Seeds of Death for me, it's like one of the... It's like the Time Monster. It's one of those stories that has been on TV and I've been in the room more times than I care to remember, but I've never properly watched it. I think from my point of view, I agree with you that all three are good choices. I'm veering towards The Crotons because I think it was the Patrick Troughton story, for whatever reason, that was selected to represent the whole era when they first did those repeats in The Five Faces of Doctor Who. So it kind of feels like we should give it the benefit of the doubt. It's Robert Holmes' first script, so...
Well, we watched Robert Holmes' last script a few episodes ago, so let's watch Robert Holmes' first script.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so The Crotons it is for season 6. That's what we'll watch, and we'll let you know how we found it next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
embrace. I don't really know how to break this to you. Brian moved out quite quickly. I can't help thinking he already had the van booked.